Okay, Plotinus has dates 205 to 270. He is the granddaddy of Western mysticism, Christian mysticism too, although Plotinus was a pagan, he was not a Christian. The second selection is concluded because of Dionysius the Areopagite, who is a Christian, but who follows Plotinus' system. And barely you can tell the difference. So, as I said, Plotinus was born in around 205. Nobody's sure for sure. 270. So he was born in Alexandria. Now, at that time, culture, there was a kind of a culture spread around a lot of countries, which was called a Hellenistic, owing to the fact that all these areas had been conquered by Alexander the Great, the pupil of Aristotle, and he had installed Greek kings over these areas. He had gone as far as into India, Alexander the Great. The famous Heliodorus column is about a Greek who was a devotee of Vasudev. So the center of Hellenistic culture and learning was Alexandria in Egypt at that time. There was a very famous library there, which was one of the wonders of the world. And it was burnt to the ground by the Muslims. They said that whatever's in this library either duplicates what's in the Quran or is different from it. If it duplicates it, it's superfluous, and if it's different, it's false. So they just burned it to the ground. So it was a huge center of learning there, like a big... and of course, the learned language was Greek. So the whole intellectual work was going on, was all in Greek. Just like later on, the language of the Eastern Church was Greek, just as the language of the Western Church became Latin. So this was in Alexandria. So in the school there, the university there, I guess it's not a university in our sense, but there was a teacher named Ammonius Iris. Ammonius Sakas was his name, of which practically nothing is known, aside from the fact that he was Plotinus' teacher, and he's considered to be the actual father of Neoplatonism. Plotinus' philosophy is called Neoplatonism. He didn't write anything. And he had another student, a Christian, one of the Christian fathers named Origen. Is famous for having taught as a Christian. I think that's how you spell it, O-R-E-G-I-N. No, that's wrong, huh? Huh? How do you do it? O-R-I-G-E-N? Yeah, that's right. Origen. Taught doctrine of transmigration, pre-existence of the soul, things like that. He was also a pupil of Ammonius Sakas. So you have two great, you have Plotinus and Origen, who are both students of the same teacher. One's a Christian, one's non-Christian. There is some evidence or some speculation that Ammonius Sakas may have been an Indian. There were Indians in Alexandria at that time. And Plotinus After he finished his education in Alexandria, tried very, very hard to go to India. There used to be, you know, caravans going that way or little armed incursions. So he tried to go to India because he thought there he would learn more about the things he wanted to know. Couldn't make it for some reason or other. Failed. And he ended up in Rome, very disgruntled in his old age that he was in the bank of the Tiber rather than the bank of the Ganges. And there was a Roman emperor named Julian the Apostate, who reverted to paganism, started persecuting the Christians and tried to start a pagan revival and wanted to make Plotinus the official philosopher of the pagan revival.
What was his name,
Julian? Julian, Emperor Julian. J-U-L-I-A-N. So anyway, that's a little brief background about Plotinus. So anyway, this philosophy is called Neoplatonism. There's always a big scholarly discussion been going on since God knows when about how much it's in Plato and how much of it's imported from the outside. You know, there are partisans on either side that say that Plato was a Neoplatonist, and others say, you know, he wasn't anything like it. It'll never be settled. But the basic idea, if you're not familiar with Plato, is a conception in Plato called what are often translated as forms or ideas. The Greek word is eidon, not ideal, idea. And this is the notion in Plato that if you have a group of things, let's call them cows, you know, you have cow A, cow B, cow C, they all share in an essence, which is just the essence of cowness. And there is, in a higher realm, this eidon, this form or idea, which is the idea of cow, or cowness, pure, abstract, essential cowness. It's not a cow. It doesn't give milk. It doesn't go moo. It's not a form. The closest thing that I can see that it corresponds to in Vedic thought is a bija, bija shakti. In the Brahmajyoti, they're the bijas, which are the seeds of all living entities. And Brahma takes those bijas and through appropriate means causes the living entities to arise. So these are something like the Platonic ideas. In Plato, so these forms or ideas, they exist in a separate realm called the intelligible realm or the realm of the ideas, which is called in Plotinus the intelligence. And a whole lot of discussion is there about idea, because you get some pretty, you know, not just cows, cow, the idea of a human, idea of man, human, life. Then you get more abstract things, like the idea of unity, the idea of diversity, the idea of being. So then there's a whole lot of things about trying to organize this realm. And the realm of the ideas has a structure. Actually, Plotinus gives the structure. I'll show you what, according to him, it is. And but in Plato, if all these things are forms or ideas, then there's the form of forms. See, all these things have in common the characteristic of being forms. So therefore they participate in something higher, which is the form of forms, which in Plato is the ultimate, which is called sometimes called the one, the true, the good, the beautiful. These things, the true, the good, and the beautiful. Which really is an interesting three, you know, it's sat, chit, ananda. the good, the true, and the beautiful. So there in Plato, there's this essence of all essences, the form of all forms, from which everything emanates. Well, does it emanate or not? It's not quite sure in Plato. But it's there. So there's this structure in Plato. And in one dialogue called the Timaeus, he introduces something called a demiurge, which is the creator deity.
That's the dialogue with Plato.
Huh? Yeah, this is the dialogue of Plato called the Timaeus. There's a demiurge who corresponds to Lord Brahma. And the demiurge takes the vision of the idea he receives. He becomes impregnated. You know, he has knowledge of these forms and he instantiates them into particular, diverse, multiple things in the world of matter. In Plato, there's this pre-existing stuff called, you know, just matter, gunk, you know, pradhan, it's somehow or other, it's just there, it's in a state of chaos. And by seeing these forms, the demiurge imposes order upon matter and the world arises. That's the account in the Timaeus.
Where does he get his inspiration from?
Up here. He contemplates the higher of the forms and also the good above it, you know. He sees all this and then makes it happen there. This is all in Plato, which sounds familiar to all of us in a sort of abstract way, you know, about Brahma being enlightened by Krishna and then receiving the power to create the world. And it's probably not an accident, all this stuff. The Greeks, according to our history, are actually deviant kshatriyas. Anyway, it's all a big mystery, you know, where all this stuff came from, where Plato got his ideas. Nobody can figure out. Anyway, that's the basic sort of Platonic notion. So these are, from our point of view, these are abstractions. You know, the forms are abstract essences. We take all human beings and we say there's some essence called humanity. And you see, these are considered to be more real because cows come and go, but cowness remains. You see, because the forms of the ideas are objects of intellectual vision rather than sensual vision, they seem to be more permanent, more long-lasting, more eternal, therefore more real than these things which come and go down here. So they're assigned a higher reality. Our tendency in the modern world is to say, you know, we're nominalists, we tend to be, that these abstractions are just mental constructions that you use, and you could divide the world up any kind of different ways you want. There are no essences. This is existential philosophy, you know. There are no essences and so on. Anyway, that's the basic idea. So this gets worked out in Plotinus with some interesting, what appear to be, variations. And definitely, I mean, in Plato, there's a lot of mysticism, too. I was originally going to do Plato for this course, but I figured, you know, like, what we need of it's in Plotinus already. But in the dialogue called the Symposium, in the Republic, there's definitely, in the Phaedo, there's talks about ascending up and seeing directly the form of the One, becoming free from desire, material attachments, and all these things, and rising up. It's in Plato. So Plotinus gets into it really with a vengeance. Oh, great, I left my notes back there. Yeah, right on my desk, there should be a sheet of yellow paper like this. On both sides, it's got page numbers and little things. So what you see here with Plotinus is he starts out trying to answer what seems to be a philosophical question. What is the source of unity? And he concludes he sets up his different things. Is it the soul? Is it the intelligence? So here he's got, when he says soul with a capital S, that corresponds to the demiurge in Plato. It's the world soul. Below that is matter. And souls. And above that is the intelligence. And above that, the one. All right, that's the picture that we get from this thing. You got it for me, thank you. And so he says on page 74, the soul makes each being one by looking upon the one. So here's the same thing in Plato. He sees this one and he gets the idea, the inspiration for oneness. And therefore, he makes each being. And then he says, each thing that is called one has a unity proportionate to its nature, sharing in unity. See, here's this notion of participation. Either more or less according to the degree of its being. So the more you approach unity or oneness, you see, the more being you have. He gives the example of composite things like a choir or a forest. See, that a forest has very little being as a unity because it possesses less unity than, say, an animal, which has more integrated, it's more got more oneness and so on. So there's this notion here that all these things, they participate in unity. So this, by virtue of this notion of somehow or other participating, the intelligence participates, but the intelligence derives its unity from another source. It's not essentially oneness, and the soul even less so, and so on. He says at the end, the soul bestows unity because it has unity, but a unity received from another source.
Does it go into detail about what that other source is?
Yeah, that's this. That's what this is all about. This is the other source. So he's just trying to separate things out here. He's arguing against the Stoics a little bit, who believe that the world soul was the ultimate. So he's saying it can't be the ultimate. And so on.
How can we speak about a unity when we speak about another source? Since the soul bestows unity, he speaks about a oneness of everything, but then he brings in another source.
Well, he's just saying that the soul itself is not in itself a unity. It's manifold as well as one. It does things. It's got parts, so to speak. It moves around. So it's not just one in itself. So it must have received this unity from somewhere else. If he has it in what he says, a contingent way. In other words, it's not necessary. Anyway, we can't spend time to get into a lot of the details here. What's going to be obscure is going to be obscure. I just want you to get the kind of picture he's trying to paint of things. But there's a notion here on page 74 where he says the soul, it is one, but its unity is contingent. So contingent means depending on something else. It means not essential. Not of its own essential nature. Usually in modern philosophy, there's necessary features and contingent features. A necessary feature makes something what it is. A contingent feature, you can take it away, and it'll still be what it is. So its unity is contingent, right? Yeah, in the soul. It's dependent. It gets its unity from somewhere else. It participates in unity. So anyway, he goes on to try to make paint his picture, how the one that we're looking for differs from being as such, because being is the collectivity of all beings, and it's not a collectivity, it's simple. It's not all beings, because all beings is multiple. Although they share in the unity of existence, they're multiple things. So the one is not just everything, but it's different from everything. He says on page 76, thus the one is not all things, because then it would no longer be one. It is not the intelligent, because the intelligence is all things, in a fashion. And the one would then be all things. It is not being, because being is all things. He's just trying to separate out his idea here. Yeah, right. So in three, you start to get toward what he's talking about. Well then, what is it? Right? Now listen to this, he says. Now after this show of kind of philosophy and defeating Aristotle and defeating, you know, the Stoics and stuff, he gets down to his real thing. How do we get knowledge of this one? As the soul advances, I'm reading section 3, page 76, toward the formless, unable to grasp what it is without contour or to receive the imprint of reality so diffuse, it fears it will encounter nothingness and it slips away. So it goes back down to earthly things, we're more familiar, sense objects, stuff like that. When he says, but when the soul seeks to know its own way by coalescence and unification. So this is something that supposedly goes on inside of us. In other words, you have to withdraw your senses from the sense objects. You have to concentrate your mind by coalescence and unification. Then he says, it is prevented by that very unification from recognizing it has found the one. For it is unable to distinguish knower and known. So when you actually encounter the one, that's all there is. You're not there to encounter it anymore. So here we come to our old famous, you know, the one without a second. You know, you vanish. There's no vision of the one. As he says later, it's not that you see it, you want it. It's not that it's seen, but it's won'd. That's what he says. So then, in the same section 3, there's a discussion about the intelligence and what that is. Because first of all, as he's saying, as you go up, you hit these levels. So here on page 77, and a little later on, page 79, he describes the intelligence. And basically, he describes in intelligence, the ideas form a structure. And he says it's like a circle, you know, a dynamic circle. Here you have the ideas. I know what he's talking about, really, here. These are all the different ideas. But you're up in a level of abstraction where they imply each other. You know, that if you understand this one, you'll understand that it implies this one, which 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 implies this one. You're back around again. But if you understand one of them, all of them will be there. So that's why it's described as a circle. Idealistic philosophies always have this structure, by the way. You run into it to get to a set of basic principles that imply each other, and therefore each one contains the other. So this is the structure of the intelligence as far as he's concerned.
Hmm? That's similar to what Socrates sometimes does, where he plods along and things, and having axioms that seem to be saying the same thing over again, but just slightly different.
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to. I don't know. Anyway, that's what Plotinus says here about the intelligence. It's not sensation. It's up there. It contemplates what's higher. It contemplates its own contents. It even contemplates what issues out of it, because all this is emanating. You know, things are emanating down. Somehow or other, the one is up there, and it's seems to be like a waterfall overflowing into the multiple world. Why it overflows, it's only answered with a metaphor, just like the sun sends out rays which gradually become dissipated by the darkness. So somehow or other there's one, you know, just... There's not a distinction between the energy and the energetic. This is vastu parinamavada, transformation of substance. Because he gives the same argument in here that the substance, that the one can be, things can come out of the one and it's never depleted. Did you recognize that? It's in here. We'll get to it. Anyway, the one is not the intelligence but higher. I'm reading on 77. The intelligence is still a being. But the one is not a being because it is precedent to all being. It precedes all being. It's before being. It causes being. So there's a principle in Plotinus here that effects are not in the cause. Not in the cause. If you are the cause of being, you cannot be a being. Because then you have to ask, well, where did your being come from? And that has to be prior. So ultimately, you know, he's got this idea. Basically, Plotinus's philosophy rests on the axiom that you can give what you haven't got. You have to give what you haven't got. When the question raises, how can you give what you haven't got? He said, it is not necessary to have it. To give. He says, so the intelligence is a being, but the one is not a being. Maybe you're thinking of it as, if you're thinking, here's this, and there's the one, a being. Nope. That's not a being. Because it is precedent to all being. Being has, you might say, the form of being. Right? That's the Platonic idea. The form of being. The one is without form, even intelligible form. That's what he means to say, intelligible form. It is not an idea. It is not an essence. See, for Plato, the highest thing was at least the essence of all essences. But for Plotinus, it's beyond essence. Can't be named, thought, spoken, you know, totally ineffable. We'll see in Dionysius, he uses the term all the time, super essential. Super essential. And then he goes on, here's his principle. As the one begets all things, it cannot be any of them. There's the cute clue to his system. Since it begets them, it cannot be them. Neither thing, nor quality, nor quantity, nor intelligence, nor soul, not in motion, not at rest, not in space, nor in time. It is the in itself uniform. It is, or rather, it is the without form, preceding form. And here is the Platonic idea of form, not what we think of shape, you know. Preceding form, movement, and rest, which are characteristic of being and make being multiple. As the one begets all things, it cannot be any of them. And in Plotinus, again, here's the principle that he assumes, and so far as I can see, never really argues for. The idea is that if something is there that's discrete, if there's some characteristic or quality that's nameable, it has to come from something that doesn't have it. Because if that source has it, then to account for its existence, you have to go somewhere else. It can't just be there, eternally there. If it's in anything, particular. Then he says at the end of 77, now notice this tricky part. Let no one object that something is contingent, that something contingent is attributed to the one when we call it the first cause. Ah, what about that? Cause. It's the cause of everything. He says, no. It is to ourselves that we are thereby attributing contingency, because it is we who are receiving something from the one, while the one remains self-enclosed. So that considered in itself, the one is not the cause of anything. It's only ourselves seeing in relationship to it that there we say it's the cause, because we're saying we're not talking about the one when we say it caused us. We're talking about ourselves. We are caused by the one. But the one is self-enclosed.
So it's just our vision.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, no, not that. Anyway, I'll show you what happens. But that's what he's saying. I want you to notice the point that it's not really the cause of it. In itself, in and of itself. If you're up here on the level of the one, you can't say it's the cause. When you're down here looking at it, then yeah, it looks like the cause. I know this doesn't. Will not hold water in Australia. Nevertheless, this is like the biggest source of Mayavada philosophy in the West, Plotinus, you know?
So it's just our vision that creates this sense of
causality. Yeah. Yeah. I'll come back to this later, this point later, because. Because here with Plotinus, I said before, he's different from Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya, remember, ultimately when you're dealing with the impersonal Brahman, it doesn't emanate a world. The world doesn't exist. It's avidya. But with Plotinus, you have a system where you have something that's entirely impersonal, you know, as negative as you can get, but from which all this layers of creation emanate. There's a flux flowing down. And then the mystic, you know, goes upstream and unites himself with the one. This is a different, and this is mostly the kind of impersonalism that you encounter among Western impersonalists. Most people, Westerners, when they read Shankaracharya, walk away with some picture like this. You know, it's a misunderstanding of Shankaracharya. You know, yeah. But as we'll see, the point I'm going to make is that if you get into Plotinus, it actually has to be the same system as Shankaracharya. Because if you get up here and there's no cause, that means from the point of view of the one, nothing else exists. Right? It's one alone. You don't see it. There's not two of you. So if you're really up there with the one, if you're united with it, it's one without us. It's the same. And when you're down here and you're looking at this system, here you get the one as distinguished from the intelligence, the soul, and all this other. Then it's one thing. It's a being, which it's not. So this is false. So really, you know, from the point of view of the one in Plotinus, if you look at it, this doesn't exist. And from the point of view of this down here, and you're looking up, the one doesn't exist, because all you see is this one that's a principle in a philosophical system, which is not the real one, which cannot be distinguished from anything which is not a being. See, as long as you're thinking of the one as a thing from which everything emanates, etc., we're not thinking of the true one, which you can't even say is a cause. So my point is that when you look at Plotinus, and then you realize that it doesn't hold together, and that really, you know, it's like he misunderstood Shankaracharya. Because Shankaracharya deals with that by setting up this. He says, yeah, there's Nirguna Brahman, from which nothing emanates, which has no effects. And then when you're looking at something from which it emanates, then there's Saguna Brahman, for which is an illusion. No, it's not a being. It doesn't exist.
No, it does if you're looking at it.
Yeah, from below, yeah, it's, you know.
So
it's,
what quality does it have to make it not the one then? Really?
Well, here in our system, we're seeing it as, we understand it's what it is by understanding it's not intelligence, it's not the world soul. So we're distinguishing it from everything else. That means it's one thing among many. But he denies that condition. He says it is not a being. It is has no intelligible form. That means this idea we have of it in this scheme of things is not really representational of the one. Well, he's tried to account for that, hasn't he? He said here, after he presents this, he says here, that really, he says, page 78, After outlining this business about the one, you know, how you can't... Awareness of the one comes to us neither by knowing nor by pure thought, but by a presence transcending knowledge. You see? When the soul knows something, it loses its unity because there's you and what you know. It cannot remain simple. Therefore, we must go beyond knowledge and hold a unity. We must renounce knowing and knowable, every object of thought, even beauty, because beauty too is posterior, subsequent to the one, and is derived from it as from the sun, the daylight. That is why Plato says of the one it can be neither spoken nor written about. If, nevertheless, we speak of it and write about it, we do so only to give direction, to urge toward that vision beyond discourse. See, this is a vision in the realm of discourse here, right? This little scheme I put on the board. To point out the road to one desirous of seeing it. Instruction goes only as far as showing the road and the direction. There's that old Buddhist saying, you know, you point to the moon and they only stare at your pointing finger, you know? So this is another self-destructive system here we got. So then he goes on about how to rise the one. The one is absent from nothing and from everything. It's in the heart of every soul and so on. Then in section 5 there's another passage about the intelligible realm, about how the ideas, you know, form this circle. It's different from our faculty of reasoning. The rational forms, after one has seen the intelligence, which like a thing of the sense is immediately perceived, embracing all things, it embraces all things and is all things. In its multiplicity, it is both indivisible and divisible. It is not divisible as are the ingredients of discursive reason conceived item by item. Still each, and he uses the expression, he uses it like a mathematical system. We have a whole bunch of theorems. Each theorem implies the other. That's the ideal, you know, mathematical system. You know, so what you get really is a kind of structure that looks like this, you know. Let's say this is the world. And you're ascending, you know, through your process of abstraction, and it goes up something like this, you know. As you get closer to the one, things become more and more unified, and then, you know, finally it reaches this vanishing point, you know. Like this, I can't draw. You know, like a cone, like a bell-shaped cone. And, you know, up here is the your ideas, you know, they become closer and closer and closer, and then, bing, in the black hole, you know? You know? Because like this is like the gravitational field around a black hole is represented like this, you know? Like a vortex, right. Because here's the circle of ideas, and as you become more and more unified, you see there's only one idea, and then, you know, it becomes more and more unified and unified, and distinction disappears. This is, and he's describing quite obviously his experience. And I'm sure he had that experience. I don't doubt it at all. That process with Plotinus, he doesn't say here, but it obviously involves, to me, to my mind, something very much like a yogic process, which he may have known about, of, you know, because he talks about how to withdraw from sensual ideas, concentrate your mind, you know, rise to the realm of the intelligible, which you can see, there's this, you know, the realm of the ideas, where these ideas are like circling around each other, engendering each other. You know, this is alive. I mean, it's like something alive is up there, you know. And then you get in it, and then like there's a vanishing point, you know, the singularity. And that's the one, you know. And when you get up there, zing, you know, you vanish. And then all your next thing you know, you're coming back down again. He talks about going up and going down. This is the structure, you know, he does. But listen to this, I mean, he says, so this multitude of coexisting beings, the intelligible realm is near the one. So first you ascend to that level. The one, the source of all things, is simple. It is above, now I'm on page 80, even the highest in the world of being, because it is above the intelligence, which itself, not the one, but like the one, would become the one, not sundered from the one, close to the one, but to itself present, it has to agree to a degree dared succession. Because you ask yourself, you know, why is this coming down? Why is it overflowing like this, you know? But it's the intelligence, he says, has dared succession. It's come down just a slight degree of being. So there's both this unity and multiplicity there, you know? Like these mathematical theorems, which entail each other and therefore contain each other. The awesome existent above, the one, is not a being, for then its unity would repose in another than itself. There is no name that suits it, but since name it we must, it may appropriately be called the one. But that is, we should not understand it as a substance that possesses unity only as an attribute. So it is strictly nameless, he says. Let's see, yeah?
You mentioned when we're looking down from one, yeah, and then we're looking up from the...
Well, if you're up there, so yeah. You know,
it doesn't exist when we look down.
Nothing, it exists, but nothing else does.
Oh, the one exists.
Yeah, the one exists.
But it doesn't really
you don't exist.
Oh. But then when you're looking, yeah, when you're looking up, now it looks like the cause of all causes.
Mm-hmm.
The causes are...
Yeah.
What else did you say? You said something else about when you're looking up?
Well, when you're looking up, you see it as a distinct entity, separate from everything else, which is the cause. You know, then it becomes the cause, the source of all good.
But it's not really an entity.
But it's not really. But then you look at what it is, you find out that thinking of it as part of a, you know, metaphysical system or as a thing besides all other things is already, you know, imposing upon it intellectual limitations. So this is basically all a fiction.
Even the intelligence of the one?
Huh?
Why does he attribute intelligence to the one?
He doesn't attribute intelligence to the one. Intelligence doesn't have any, it doesn't think. He said it's not like something that thinks, it's more like thought itself. Whatever that means. Huh? No, it's just self-thinking, it's just thought, you know? He describes the mystical experience as going up, staying for a while, and falling back down at the very end of this thing.
It comes back to mundane consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That one comes back down to mundane consciousness. He says here, page 82, but the one in its aloneness can neither know nor be ignorant of anything. Being with itself, it does not need to know itself. 82. Excluded from it are both thinking of itself and thinking of others. It is not like that which thinks, but rather like the activity of thinking. The activity of thinking does not itself think. It is the cause that has some other being. It is the cause that has some other being think, and cause cannot be identical with its effect. That's a very basic proposition with him. The cause, therefore, of all existing things cannot be any one of them. Because it is the cause of good, it cannot then be called the good. He calls it the good all the time. But because it causes good, it can't be the good. That's his essential assumption. Our Prabhupada always argues, you know, you cannot give what you have not got. If there's name and form here, there has to be name and form above. But for Plotinus, name and form means it's contingent. You know, it has to have some source that's nameless and formless. Otherwise, you couldn't count for its existence. You know, that's.
He says the good is not the cause of all good.
Yeah, it is. Because it is the cause of good, it cannot therefore be called the good. Yet in another sense, it is the good above all. Yeah, it's the cause of good, but therefore, see, it causes good, right? Here's good, right? So it causes good. So how do you explain good? Well, because it has this source. But if this source is also good, they say, well, where does that come from? So you have to find something that's the source of it, which doesn't have it, but which begets it. That's somehow or other his thinking runs like this.
What's the problem with the source having the quality of the...
Well, as best I can understand it, I realize I'm going to do any more of this work, I'm going to have to get into this causality trip, you know. But, I mean, one, you know, philosophical arguments about the nature of causality are just endless. But, you know, in Vedanta, in Buddhist thought here too, a lot of it hinges upon how people conceive of or think of causality. But, you know, he says the cause cannot be identical with the effect. Because if the cause is identical with the effect, then the cause and effect are one and the same thing, and there is no cause, there is no effect. Something like that. You know.
Is this philosophy kind of the basis for a lot of Christian...
Yeah, it becomes the basis. You didn't do your reading, did you?
No, I didn't.
I can tell.
That's how I got the picture of this Christian trance with God with no face. You
know? Well, yeah.
Even that's a little bit too...
That doesn't really come from this, but... Yeah, 3 miles high. You know, this Plotinus is better than 3 miles high. Anyway, on page 82, there's the famous metaphor also. Is it 82? No, it's later on. Excuse me. We're not going to finish. We run out of time. I see I'll have to go on with this tomorrow. Anyway, start doing the reading for tomorrow. Let me just leave you with a last thought. You see, you kind of got this structure from Western mysticism, Platonic mysticism, you know, of this cone going up. So I'm going to just make this a small... This will represent the cone, just a triangle like this goes up, right? They get to this point. Now, what I want to suggest is, you know, there's a dividing line, and then there's this. There's a tree with his roots upwards and his branches downward. And they come up to here, and they can't have any access to this. This is what you're seeing.
Impure intelligence.
Impure, you know, Plotinus, for all his purification and elimination, you know, just arrives at the point of singularity. But if you go through the black hole, that's what we say, this is nirvana, you know, the sensation of material existence. So things come to a thing. But it comes up the other side like this. This is that tree, the other tree, which they don't have any access. Because all of this, you notice, this is raising yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Well, even what is their life? I mean, it may just not even be the rendering of a realization, but just activity of the mind and the intelligence. Are those persons living purely or stealing?
Well, let's say this Plotinus, let's take him at his word that he has these experiences, you know. I mean, why not? I don't really like to go around saying to people you don't experience what you claim to do.
No, but maybe a fallen yogi that recalls that from previous life. Or
oh, yeah.
Raising
up sure.
And get those experiences.
My feeling about Plotinus is he probably engaged in some yoga practice. That's why he wanted to go to India. Not so much for philosophy, but for technique. Because Plotinus always talks about going up and coming back down and going up and coming back down, you know. And because you can't stay up here. It's so, you know, precarious that you end back down. And he tells you when you come back down, don't lose heart. Just get ready to go back up again. But as soon as you become attached to the things of this world, you know, then you're anchored and you can't get back up. So you have to break all your attachments. So I imagine he was a fairly austere man, you know. And with Dionysius, you know, Dionysius, the Areopagite here in the mystic theology, he was probably a 5th century Syrian monk who wrote under the name of Dionysius, who was a disciple of St. Paul. But everyone agrees since about the 17th century that this book is much later and that... He was probably a 5th century Syrian monk. Well, in the Eastern Church, one of the big compilations of Eastern Christianity is the book called Philokalia, which has to do with the sayings of the fathers of the Church. And you read that, they're doing breathing exercises, they're practicing yoga, they're constant channeling in the name of God. You know, all this stuff is going on there. So we may say, you know, you may assume that at least with some of them, there was a degree of practice and a degree of renunciation. And you can get something. As we'll see in the selection we read about Arthur Koestler, he became suddenly very renounced because he was in a prison cell in Spain and every day they were taking people out and shooting them and he didn't know when he was going to be shot. And he became very renounced very fast. After it was all over, of course... He went back to his normal modes of existence, but he had an acute sense of the contingency of all being and of detachment from the world by the fact that every day he was watching hearing these guys get shot out of his window, and he never knew when they were going to come and grab him. And in that state of crisis, he had this mystic experience, you know. Okay, so until tomorrow, Glorious Prabhupada.